You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Now, tell me about your father.
City Counselling on 95BFM, our weekly chat with the good people of Auckland Council.
Tāmaki was hit with severe heavy rain warnings in recent days, with extreme weather and states of emergency declared around the motu. This heightened caution around risks of flooding in areas affected by the 2023 Auckland anniversary floods. Last week, there were also changes to national laws that now allow granny flats to be built on properties without the need to obtain resource consent, and stripping of marine life from rock pools around Whangaparoa has raised discussion of shellfish protections, but not without increasing racial tensions and community discourse. I spoke to Councillor Julie Ferry about how these topics impact Tāmaki Makaurau. Tāmaki has been faced with heavy rain this week along with the rest of the motu. Do you have any messages for those who may be fearing severe impacts, especially following our 2023 flooding?
Yeah, I think it's really important to acknowledge up front a lot of people get really anxious when it rains, and that's totally fair. I have groups in my community who, they don't sleep the nights when there's heavy rain because they've had terrible experiences in 2023, and then in some cases, and it was around this time of the year, of course, that 2023 stuff, and then in some cases also at Easter last year. So it is really stressful for people. The good news is that council is way better prepared than it was in 2023. Our communication with the community about risks and what they can do ahead of time is much better, and so following the Auckland Emergency Management channels, particularly their Facebook, they put a lot of their information up on there, and sharing that information with your neighbours, checking in on people, that kind of stuff. But also just want to acknowledge that my area has been hard hit in the past, that's Albert Eden Puketapapa, but this time around it seems to be our friends in Rodney with some really awful flooding up there, and of course further north in Northland. I'm not sure, because I haven't seen on the news yet, but it's possible that someone has lost their life again in flooding. Don't enter flood water, unless you absolutely have to get to safety. Ask for help. Listen to the messages, I guess, about staying home when they are given, and look out for your neighbours. It does look as if it's not going to be as bad from here as it has been the last couple of days, but as we all know, unfortunately, it will keep raining. Well, not unfortunately, it's part of the natural cycle. So it's just something we have to not so much get used to, but I guess be prepared for in a way that perhaps in the past we took for granted. So there's some really good resources online about making your own property safer during flooding, but also work with your neighbours to advocate to your local board, your local councillors, central government, for the local improvements that we need too. And I know that the group around the Upper Foe catchment in my area, they're holding a meeting tonight for the community to get together and talk about, how do we work together to get the kinds of projects and improvements in that area that we need to not be anxious every time it rains at night. So there's initiatives like that happening all over the place. So have a look out for that in your community.
And what are your thoughts on how changes to granny flat consent rules will impact our city?
Yeah, so the granny flat stuff is quite interesting, and it's one of the things I find interesting about it is that people are referring to them as granny flats rather than tiny homes. So for those who are new to this issue, what's being referred to as a granny flat in this context doesn't have to be for a grandparent. It's a standalone second dwelling that's being built on a site that already has a house. It has to be separate, so it can't sort of be built on the side. It has to be sort of, I think it's 2 metres away from a boundary or another building. So it has to be separate. It has to have its own separate water connections and things like that. And it can be up to 70 square metres, which, to give people a sense of context, is about a quarter of the size of a tennis court. It can only be one storey. I have seen designs where you can fit two bedrooms, but you've also got to have, you know, kitchen, bathroom, all of that kind of stuff. And those can now be, as of the 15th of January, built on sites where there's no natural hazard risks, like flooding or landslide, without resource consent. You do need to notify council that you're doing it beforehand, and you need to notify them when it's finished. There are some forms to fill out, there are some fees to pay, and it needs to be done by licensed professionals who will sign off the work. So in theory, if all of that works well, we could see some more opportunities for people who are happy to live in smaller settings like that, where people who maybe own the main house or own the land that it's on could potentially build a second dwelling for you know, aging parents who need to be close by, want to be close by, for adult children who are looking for a chance to live separately from their parents. My eldest just turned 18, so that's in the back of my mind. He's not moving out of home anytime soon, but that could be an option. Those kinds of things. Another form of income that could be rented out. Those kinds of things, right? But there is potentially a risk here because it's not being resource consented, that there might be some issues around quality, that we might find in, you know, 5 or 10 years that some of these buildings haven't been well built. And so the people living in them, particularly if they're renting, may find themselves in really substandard environments that aren't appropriate. So it's going to be interesting to see how it rolls out. There's an opportunity here to create some more housing, smaller housing, that we need, particularly in places closer to the city where people can access services and transport, jobs, education, all that kind of stuff. But that quality stuff is going to be really important because it's not signed off through the resource consenting process. So I'm optimistic about it, gives people more flexibility, but I have a little caution there in the back of my mind about that quality aspect as well. So I guess we'll just have to keep an eye on that.
And last week, there were reports of rock pools in bays in Whangaparoa being stripped by visitors. What are council's powers over protection of marine life?
So there's quite a lot of stuff that's happened basically since the early 90s around tightening the rules around collection of shellfish. A lot of this is overseen by and enforced by fisheries. So from time to time, people might see if they're at the beaches or around rocky cliffs areas and stuff like that, you might see a fisheries officer, and they're there checking that people are not exceeding the limit. So a lot of fish in particular have catch limits, so the fish you catch have to be over a certain size for you to keep them, otherwise you have to put them back in the water so they can get bigger and breed and that kind of stuff. And there might be, you know, like you're only allowed 5 of this species a day or whatever. And so those rules around fish have been in place for a long time and have been tweaked and stuff in response to how those fish populations are going and stuff like that. In the shellfish space, there hasn't been as much regulation, and there are some species that are not really regulated at all, except by a general catch limit, which is 50 a day maximum. And so now that we're seeing more threats to those shellfish populations, this issue potentially of people taking all the fish of a species that they see on a beach. Some of it's because we have people living in New Zealand now who are used to eating those species, and they, you know, have eaten those species in countries they've come from, but New Zealanders who've lived here for a long time didn't eat those species. So some of it's about a change in the kinds of food that people eat. Some of it's about just, you know, cost of living, frankly, that this can be a cheap way of sourcing food, and people are desperate for that food. So some of it is an education thing about saying, hey, you know, some of these populations are under threat. We need to take less. And not take the really small ones. Some of it is actually, frankly, about how do we make sure that everybody has enough food to eat, that they're not having to make quite desperate choices. So there's two things happening at the moment around the shellfish, particularly that area around the Whangaparoa Peninsula, where Ngāti Manuhiri, one of the iwi for the area, have requested through fisheries Arahui, so a ban on taking shellfish in those areas for 2 years. Fisheries had submissions open for that closed in November, and the minister is making a decision on that in the next month. Council has put a submission in on that as well, and also more generally Fisheries is putting together some proposals which will be looked at in April that are a bigger picture about some of this shellfish taking that might not be sustainable, and as I say needs an education focus but also an enforcement focus, so that we have this shellfish in the future.
And could you share a comment on the racial tensions arising in community dialogue and conversations about addressing this marine life preservation?
Yeah, I think it's really sad that some people sort of go straight there. I have seen some comments about it being migrants. Some people have picked out specific types of migrants. I don't know that that's particularly helpful, because I think there's probably plenty of people who aren't migrants who don't know the rules. But I think also we do need to acknowledge that there are people who live in New Zealand who have come from cultures where they eat the little shellfish. And that's more of an education piece. I don't think anybody's out there wanting to destroy species. I think people are just perhaps not aware. And so I think there is some value in making sure that the communication that goes out about this stuff happens in a multitude of languages, that it involves community leaders from a multitude of communities. But I don't think it's very helpful to blame people. I mean, I remember in the 90s, when there was a lot of stuff around Asian drivers, and actually if you looked at the stats, it really wasn't borne out. It's just that people were more visible, and I suspect there might be something similar going on here too, is that, you know, yeah. So I guess I would just encourage people to see this as a chance to communicate across cultures as opposed to blaming. And assume the best. Assume that people are have good intentions and don't necessarily know that what they're doing is potentially breaking a rule or potentially harmful, even if it's not technically breaking a rule. And, you know, give them the benefit of the doubt. That's what I would appreciate if I was in if I moved to a different country and was doing something that other people didn't like.
That was Councillor Julia Ferry on this week's Heavy Rain and Threats of Flooding, Changes to Granny Flat Building Regulations and Marine Protections of Shellfish.
Have you tried mindfulness? Try mindfulness.
City Counselling on 95BFM.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.